This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Hutchins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Madden. What are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
Always enjoy the chance to talk to one of NBC's great Formula One announcers in the new season just underway. 2014 champ Lewis Hamilton picking up where he left off by winning the opening race in Australia. To talk about that and much more, we're joined by NBC's Formula One play-by-play man, Lee Diffie. Lee, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Thank you very much for having me.
We'll get to F1 in a bit, but first, your journey to NBC. Many fans, of course, know you from your time with Speed, an auto racing veteran here on American shores. But how did you, a native Australian, get to the States and become so involved in auto racing coverage here?
Well, I guess, first of all, I think I have to say I'm very fortunate, and I don't take my position for granted at any stage or any day. But it was a long journey for sure. I grew up in a motorsport family. With my brother and myself and my father were involved in racing motorcycles, and so that was my entry into it. I started out working at local, dirt tracks, commentating motorcycle racing, and then it went to cars, and then through right time, right place, and some good opportunities, I ended up getting into television in Australia, calling everything from V8 supercars to MotoGP, everything that had a wheels and a motor in Australia I was involved in. And I went to the Le Mans 24 Hour in France in the late 1990s and really got the bug for being overseas. And I only worked in television in Australia for 3.5 years, and I left and I went to the UK and had some good contact there and was just doing little bits and bobs. In fact, I commentated on Danica Patrick when she was in the British Formula Ford Championship.
Wow.
Strange, when you go back in the past and the things you do and then the people who pop up again in your life down the road. And I was very lucky to, again, through connections and right time, right place, I ended up getting employed by the BBC after being in London for less than a month and to be their play-by-play on World Superbikes. And so worked on a World Championship for a couple of years and did World Rally for them and various other projects, and I was able to call two IndyCar races in 2001, right around 9/11, for ESPN International, and one of those races was the tragic one in Germany where Alex Zanardi lost his leg, and just by being exposed to IndyCar people back in those days in the, when it was called CART, they offered me a job to leave England and to come to America. And so I worked for them for 1 year, and then that then exposed me to Speed Channel, and I spent the next 10 years with Speed. So kind of a long journey. That's the very short version of it, but it's been an amazing journey, and I truly love being here. I've become an American citizen, and this country and the television culture here has treated me unbelievably well.
Pretty amazing journey across the world. That took you to Sochi here for the Winter Olympics last year. And I think a lot of our readers were definitely fans of your work calling luge and bobsled, some of the exciting events from the Sankey Sliding Center that we get to enjoy every 4 years. Just how cool was it to be a part of the Olympics, be a part of those broadcasts, and have these sports, luge, skeleton, bobsled, that may have some of that thrill that is there with auto racing, but also completely different sports. So first, how cool was that experience for you? And then what were the challenges like to come into these sports and try to call that action?
Well, it was, to your question, it was incredibly cool. I mean, I never thought in my life I'd go to Russia, let alone go to Russia and call an Olympics for NBC. So that was without being too dramatic, that was a life-changing moment. It was amazing. And then, to call all three of those disciplines it was a lot of hard work. And I was, I'm kind of coming up close to working in the industry of network television for 20 years. So you don't get nervous per se, but you definitely, whenever you step outside your comfort zone, and I've done other sports, and the reason you like stepping away from auto racing for a project purpose is because when you get out of your comfort zone, you kind of almost raise your game, so to speak, because you're not from that sport or you don't have a long history in that sport. You know that perhaps people will be paying more attention because of that factor that you're not around it or haven't been around it for a long time. So it really makes you perhaps put in that extra percentage, that extra work, and it was great. Worked with a terrific team of people, of Olympians and folks who've been around the sport all their lives through their families, and got to know some of the amazing Team USA athletes, and just I mentioned the phrase right time, right place. But the Stanky Sliding Center was, for us, it was alive because Team USA won a quarter of the medal count. And so for us as NBC, as a broadcaster, host broadcaster here in the States, it was incredible. You know, unfortunately, some of the bigger names on Team USA and other sports didn't perform, but then all of a sudden, the sliding athletes really turned it on. And I think the American public really warmed to that because there's some tremendous human interest stories within each discipline of the Olympics, the sports that are on offer. But the sliders, there's some really interesting people, and they've made some pretty amazing journeys. And of course, you know, in the women's bobsled, we had Lola Jones and Lauren Williams, who, you know, two unique stories unto themselves. So there was plenty going on, and it was a fabulous, fabulous experience.
As someone who has worked at Speed and now made the trek to NBC, I want to get your perspective on this. We wrote over the weekend how it almost seems like NBC has become the de facto new home for motorsports, IndyCar, then adding F1, now adding NASCAR. Speed was that, certainly, for a number of years. Then, of course, the change came to Fox Sports 1, and you kind of wondered, okay, where are the auto racing fans going to go? What's going to be that main central network for racing fans? And now that all three of those series are at NBC, do you feel like that network now, NBCSN, is the home for racing fans, especially after what's happened with Speed? And do you feel like there's still maybe some outreach to happen to draw some of those motor racing fans into the network to say, hey, look, you know, this is the new home for motorsports now with these three major series on board?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I mean, I started, a couple of years ago with one of our coordinating producers and saying, hey, is it okay if we kind of use the tag at the end of each broadcast? Thanks for watching, whatever it might have been. Thanks for watching the Verizon IndyCar series, or thanks for watching Formula 1 on your home of open wheel racing. And literally just this year we've changed that, and we say, you know, thanks for watching whatever it is on your home of motorsport, because we are, and we consider that we are because of the properties that we have. And it's exciting. Yeah, Speed was cool to be a part of, and I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you without Speed. But this is almost better because it's NBC and you've got all the other sports, all the other properties that we have, English Premier League, NFL, NHL. So it's almost everything you want from a motorsport perspective and more. So for that reason, it's very cool. And you have even within, you know, our four walls at NBC Sports Group, you have the people who work on the other properties taking an interest in motorsport now because it's part of the family. And that's really cool. It's very, very gratifying.
Of course, you call IndyCar races on NBC along with the Formula One coverage. What's the challenge like to make the transition back and forth between the two open wheel series? Because they are very, very different in terms of Formula One's global scale. And of course, IndyCar is the domestic series here in America.
Well, it's not challenging. Like, it's not like it's a huge hurdle to jump over. It's quite a comfortable, week to week transition. And I think, to your point, because they're so different, that's what makes it not too bad. You know, I think probably it would be more difficult if they were more similar, but they're so different that that's what makes it fine, I think. Work with some of the same people, but predominantly they're two different teams of people. So on F1, as you well know, and I work with David Hobbs and Steve Matchett in the booth. Well, on IndyCar, I, for the most part, it's myself, Townsend Bell, and Paul Tracy. And just that in itself, Matt, is a fascinating difference and diversity right there. And then just in those four guys, you know, very different backgrounds, very different stories to tell. You know, David drove in an era completely different to Paul Tracy and Townsend, and they all bring different things to the table. And then Steve brings his, you know, engineering and mechanical background to the table. So, I mean, even just the change of scenery for people, you know, makes it kind of, you look, oh, I get to work with Townsend this week, looking forward to that. And then you come back, oh, I get to work with Hobbo and Steve this week, looking forward to that, you know. So, it, for me, the life never gets boring.
Yeah, very interesting insights. All right, let's dig into the Formula One season just a bit. Opening week already in the books in Australia, and it seems like, Lee, for those that follow this sport closely, Formula One is never shy of controversy, and that seems to be especially true at the start of the season. We've got drivers suing teams, drivers missing races due to injury, teams showing up not having cars that are fit to race. You've got Red Bull threatening to quit. In some sense, all of this controversy, it seems to be one of the selling points of Formula One, the drama that goes with this series. But how do you begin to make sense of all of this? And even by Formula One standards, is this a pretty crazy start to the season with all this happening?
It's kind of like, remember that old cartoon show, Wacky Races? It was almost like that. It was... Yeah, it certainly was an interesting weekend, for want of a better word or a better phrase. And then, in amongst all of that, you have unbelievable positive stories, like Felipe Nasr from Sauber, the rookie driver, finishing fifth. I mean, I was blown away with that. But as far as all of the off-track drama that you were alluding to, it was a little bit like Days of Our Lives. It was quite the soap opera. And yeah, you know, Formula One doesn't have a long history of drivers taking teams to court and winning, but I mean, yes, you know, controversy definitely is part of Formula One, and it always has been, and I guess that's part of the allure of the sport, you know, just one element of it. But so for that, it wasn't anything different, but it was really just with the scope of the week and what happened, you know, with Manor not even turning a wheel and not quite sure on what the story is there. The FIA have said they've got nothing to answer to, so that's kind of for us in between now and the Malaysian Grand Prix, stand by and see what happens. Bottas getting injured in the way that he did was quite freaky, very odd, and really felt for him because he's such a star. I thought he and Daniel Ricciardo were the two, you know, outside the Mercedes boys last year, he and Ricciardo were the two standouts, and I think, and I've said this on the broadcast many times, I think that we're going to be saying Valtteri Bottas and Daniel Ricciardo's name in Formula One for a long time. So I'm not sure how much depth there is to the rumblings of Red Bull, you know, going to pull out. There's such a force that, you know, Bernie Ecclestone and the owners of Formula One TVC Capital Partners, that they need to take notice, the FIA need to take notice. But I kind of remember a couple of years ago when they were dissatisfied with the tyres that Pirelli were bringing to the racetrack, and they were working better for the Mercedes and the Ferrari, and they weren't working so well for Red Bull. And they kind of made similar rumblings. They never ever threatened to pull out of the sport, but they, when things aren't particularly working well for them, they get very vocal. And I'm not sure if that's their, you know, strategy to get it done. Of course it is, you know. But I don't know. That again will be an interesting one to monitor and see if their power, you know, politically, financially, is enough to get anything changed. And, you know, as a viewer, as a fan, you know, nobody wants to see a Mercedes run away. Everybody wants to see competition. So, but that's one of the great things that I thought of the 2014 championship. Yeah, fair enough. Mercedes ran away with it easily in the Constructors' Championship, and they won, you know, every race bar three. But the fight between the two Mercedes guys made the championship for me, and you know, we have to call it every week, every other week. It made it fascinating because that battle was so close. So yeah, I think you know, as part of all of that rumblings from Melbourne, you know, today the Sauber/Guido Vandergaard thing has been put to bed. allegedly made a payment to him out of court. They've settled it, and they're saying that's it. We're moving forward now with our drivers, Marcus Ericsson and Felipe Nasr, and just today announced a new sponsor as well in Singapore Airlines. So as far as they're concerned, it's over. As far as Guido Vandergaard's concerned, he wants it to be a real line in the sand moment for the way drivers are treated and handled by teams, and make sure that the certain ethics are followed. So he's kind of being somewhat of a pioneer in that regard. And, you know, at the end of the day, Matt, that's very important within the sport, but that's nothing that we really delve into, and I don't think it affects you and I as a viewer and as somebody who works in the industry. So, but, you know, you definitely don't like to see it happen.
One of the interesting things you bring up there is the dominance of Mercedes and how last year the focus really was on teammates as they battled for the title, Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg. What is the current state of that rivalry at Mercedes? And once again this year, is Rosberg Lewis Hamilton's only real competition this year? And do you expect to see any sparks fly that we saw last year?
I think I'm not sure we're going to see it. I think the intensity will be every bit as what it was last year. I'm just not sure we're going to see that, you know, like the incidents at Spa or the way they drove against each other in Bahrain. You remember the night race in Bahrain last year? I mean, that was incredible. And that was really the beginning of it, where we got to see how they felt about each other and how they were going to treat each other on the track. I don't think we're going to see it get to that level again this year, but I think, you know, within each driver's head, I think the intensity's there, and it's going to be every bit like it was last year. And hey, who knows? We're standing back, taking a little bit of an outside look in, but I think the way that he conducted himself last weekend, I think Lewis now just getting that second championship, kind of having to, he can exhale now. He doesn't have to wonder, you know, was 2008 my only chance? And now he's got what he believes he always should have had, a second championship, and there's no reason to say he's not going to get more. He's getting very close to Vettel in overall wins, all-time wins, and I just think that he's carrying himself now with a little bit of extra swagger, and I think that he's got Rosberg psychologically. Just before they even sit in the car, I think he's got something a little bit more, whereas last year, I'm not sure Lewis even knew. I think we all presumed that, and, you know, there were statements from Niki Lauda and Toto Wolff and whoever else wanted to chime in on and give their, you know, 2 cents worth on what they thought about each driver. But I think whereas Lewis perhaps didn't even know because of the way that Nico responded last year and just kept coming back at him, and then he got those wins, and Lewis had some reliability issues, and that was kind of, you know, we were describing Hamilton's season as a 2 steps forward, 1 step back. But the way he finished out last year and the way that he's begun this year, so he's won, if you go, you know, count to Melbourne and go backwards, he's won 8 of the last 9 races. I just think he's kind of got that, he feels he's got that extra little edge over Rosberg. So to answer your question, yeah, Rosberg is probably going to be his only competition in a tight fight, just, you know, nothing happening, reliability issues or anything. But I think Lewis is going to have the edge.
8 of 9 is a pretty good stretch for any athlete in any sport, I think. And for Hamilton, you know, you mentioned the second title last year. It's kind of remarkable to think that he's only 30 years old because it seems like he's been around forever. But given Mercedes and their domination and the edge that Hamilton seemingly has over Rosberg, do you think we're looking at another stretch here like a Sebastian Vettel, like a Michael Schumacher, where we might see Lewis Hamilton reel off 3, 4, 5 championships in a row? I mean, is anybody even close to stopping Hamilton and Mercedes from accomplishing that feat?
I don't think so. Not from, if you just judge it on last year and what we've seen in Australia.
Wow.
What they're able to do on prime tyre versus everybody else on option tyre. I mean, that car is just unbelievable, and it just seems to do. Do you remember the old baseball movie with Robert Redford, The Natural? You know, yes. And there's a part in the movie there where they say this guy can do whatever he wants. He can hit whatever he wants, when he wants. The ball goes, wherever he wants it to go. And at the moment, it seems like, you know, for Hamilton and Rosberg and Mercedes-AMG Petronas, they can do whatever they want to do at the moment. That car is just so fast and so together. And the only thing that was beating them last year was their own poor reliability. And if now, in this off-season, they have that fixed, well, I don't see anybody stopping them. I'm massively relieved to see the Ferrari look competitive, somewhat competitive. But basically, if you look at the gap last year at the Australian Grand Prix from the race winner to the first Ferrari, which was Alonso, it was 35-plus seconds. This year, from the winner, which was Lewis Hamilton, to the first Ferrari, which was Vettel, was about 34 seconds. So, yeah, the Ferrari looks a bit more competitive, but if you take the facts are they're basically the same distance from the first Grand Prix behind the winner.
Daunting statistics for the rest of the season for the field. And it was, I think, pretty nicely to see a bit of needle there between Rosberg and Vettel with the Mercedes and Ferrari to give some kind of interest, because at least if they're not going to be too competitive on the track, at least get some of those fires, you know, going in the media, at least bring some sort of intensity to this competition, because it seems like, as you've stated, the season is shaping up to be a bit of a mirror of 2014. So you're kind of just hoping, I think, Lee, for the benefit of the sport, for the benefit of the drama and the storylines that go with it, that one of these teams, be it Ferrari, be it someone else, or at least just one driver, to get up there and mix it up with those Mercedes guys to at least add a new wrinkle to what we saw last year.
And I think that's why Daniel Ricciardo, in addition to his wonderful personality, I think that's why Daniel Ricciardo last year just gained, you know, a few extra million fans around the world, because he did beat them. Canada, he beat them because of poor reliability on the Mercedes front. But the other races, he beat them fair and square. And I mean, that race in Hungary where he came back through the field and then passed them and passed Alonso again was absolutely fascinating and fabulous. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it was Daniel Ricciardo in a Red Bull, you know, it could have been Sebastian Vettel then in a Red Bull, or it could have been Kimi Raikkonen in a Ferrari, any driver, it doesn't matter that it was Ricciardo. I mean, that was just a gutsy, gritty drive. And so to be, you know, imagine if this year Mercedes wins all 20 Grand Prix, but now, unfortunately, with Germany in doubt, it looks like it's going to be 19 Grand Prix. Imagine if Mercedes went to get that perfect season and win all 19 Grand Prix this year. And at the end of a two-year span, Daniel Ricciardo can stand back and say, I'm the only guy that's beaten Mercedes-AMG in 2 years. That would be pretty special.
That's quite the statement. It's almost like we see the NCAA tournament starting. It's almost like you compare the team to Kentucky and their dominance and their run at perfection. It's almost like we could see that kind of storyline developed this year, and that would be a big statement to say that I was the only guy over a possible two-year stretch to best this team. One team that is at the opposite end of the spectrum right now is one of the great teams in Formula One history, and that is McLaren. Shocking, really, Lee, to see them at the back of the pack in Australia. Jenson Button, the last finisher in the race. How did they get there, and how does this team try to turn it around?
Well, that's a great question.
Probably not a simple answer to that question, around. Or they would have figured it out by now, I think.
Yeah. There's no simple answer, and I'm sure Ron Dennis, and I'm sure Yasuhisa Arai, the gentleman in charge of the Honda Racing program, I'm sure they both want that simple single word answer or whatever it might be, but it's not. It's going to be a long turnaround. But we said it on the broadcast last weekend, and I think we have to keep saying it, not only for ourselves, but for our viewers and for F1 fans. We have to remember these days. We have to remember the beginning of the 2015 season, because when we say Fernando Alonso wins wherever, or Jenson Button wins wherever, or however long this is going to take, we are kind of almost like on a reverse hill. You know, we're right at the bottom of the hill right now. And when we're standing on top of that hill, we have to remember that climb, because it is going to be, for us as broadcasters, for all of our viewers, it's going to be an amazing journey. And they will get there. And they'll get there simply because they are McLaren and they are Honda. Just two unbelievable blue chip racing in their DNA. It's what it's all about, and winning in their DNA. So they're not going. There's just way too much money, way too much faith. You know, way too much at stake and invested for this program not to succeed. And I just, you know, they've had 6 years, they being Honda, have had 6 years out of the sport, to have another manufacturer come in and take on Mercedes. Now, Renault's got issues at the moment, but, you know, to have another big global manufacturer and brand come in and say, we're going to take the fight to you, Mercedes-Benz. That's only good. That's only good for the sport. That's awesome for the sport. So I just can't. I can't, like you. I couldn't believe what I was seeing when we, when David Hobbs and myself and some of our team went to the second test, which was the second of three. The first one in Barcelona, we couldn't believe our eyes what we were seeing with McLaren Honda. I mean, the 4 days that we were in Barcelona. With my own eyes, never saw that McLaren turn more than half a dozen laps in succession. Didn't do more than six laps in succession, whether it was Alonso before his crash or Button. And I was saying to David Hobbs, can you believe this thing? And then we saw it stop. We saw it stop and break down multiple times. And then nothing, you know, so boy, it's going to be a tough old road in Australia. Nothing changed at the last test, the third test in Barcelona. And then nothing changed in Australia. You know, before Jensen Button saw the lights go out on Sunday, he didn't even know if he was going to make the end of the race because he hadn't done more than 12 laps in a row. And the race was 58 laps. So, I mean, they finished, and unfortunately he was the only one in the race not to get a point. But, I mean, there's number one. That's the first check where they say, okay, we did that, we achieved that, which was finishing a race. I mean, this sounds ridiculous to be talking about this level of team and reputation and organisation that they can be satisfied in just finishing a race, but that's what's going to make this climb, and that's what's going to make their success one of the most amazing stories. You know, and I think they will do it. We're just going to have to sit around for a while to watch and wait until they do it.
Seeing McLaren struggle that badly, it's almost like watching the Lakers this season. Like, aside from the name on the uniform, you would have never guessed that team could produce that kind of performance. But you're right, maybe it will make the comeback story that much more dramatic and interesting. I'm interested to get your take on this, Lee. You know, we talk about the struggles of McLaren, the success of Mercedes. We've seen the dominance of teams like Red Bull, teams like Ferrari over the years. And the debate that always interests me about Formula One, with the multi-million cars, with the cutting-edge technology, how much of your success is owed to the car, and how much is owed to the driver? You can ask the same question in NASCAR. You look at the run of success that Jimmy Johnson has had. But in Formula One, there's so much emphasis on technology, so much money spent. Could any driver from the field step into Lewis Hamilton's seat and do what he's doing? And on the other end of the spectrum, could any driver step into that McLaren and still find those same struggles? So I guess the overarching question that I want to get your perspective on is, just how much of the success is attributed to the car, how much to the driver, and does the dominance of these teams in these long stretches, the Ferrari dynasty with Schumacher, the Red Bull dynasty with Vettel, now Hamilton, maybe he puts together that stretch of three or four or five championships in a row, does that maybe lean the argument to say, you know what, maybe it's the car that really leads the way and the driver is just kind of steering that ship, whether for good or for bad?
There's definitely what percentage you allocate is difficult to articulate and be precise, but the percentage is definitely more on the car side than the driver. But I really don't believe that just anybody could step into Lewis Hamilton's car and deliver what he's delivering. I really don't believe that. And we weren't privy to the information or what they were doing what at that particular stage of the day, what the program or what the objective was. But at the test in Barcelona that I was at, we got to see the young Mercedes. He's part of the Mercedes family, Pascal Wehrlein, who's done DCM, and he is a very talented and well-regarded driver within the Mercedes stable and family. And they they being Mercedes-Benz, they wanted to get this young guy seat time in a Formula One car. But they actually paid Sahara Force India to take their 2014 car so Wöhrlein could actually get some laps on track in a Formula One car at Barcelona. And then what happened was the team used that money wisely to stay for the entire test. And even though it was the 2014 car, they ran and got tyre data, and there was actually some usefulness out of the test other than just getting some money to run Wöhrlein. Well, later that day, Lewis Hamilton fell ill, and I think he had the flu. He definitely was running a fever, and just he couldn't drive. And Rosberg wasn't out of the track that day, so this Pascal Wöhrlein got to drive the Sahara Force India 2014 car in the morning, and in the afternoon he got to drive the Mercedes AMG Petronas. And guess what? His times were nowhere near what the regular drivers are. So I mean, if it was just a point squirt shoot deal, he should have been running times at the front. Like I said, we weren't privy to what program they were running, what the objective was, etc. But his times weren't that flattering. So, yes, the car carries more of the weight, for sure. There's no arguing that. And then in this day and age, it's all about engine, you know. I mean, that was Ferrari's problem last year, aero versus engine, and they were lacking in the engine department. So with these V6 turbocharged hybrids, there's even more emphasis on having that right power and the power delivery and the drivability. But the driver is still a massive part to it. You know, there's guys out there that, you know, when you do the talent distribution, that's what makes the great champions, is what they can bring to the table. And I don't think there's any better evidence about the car carrying more of the percentage, allocated percentage, than last year with Sebastian Vettel. He couldn't drive that car. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the driving characteristics that suited his style. Look at Kimi Raikkonen at Ferrari. He's already, even though he didn't finish the race on Sunday, he's already much happier with that car because they built it around his driving characteristics. And for whatever reason, Daniel Ricciardo came to grips with that car, the Red Bull car last year. It worked for him. It didn't work for Vettel. And have a look at Vettel. Vettel only had four podiums last year. Came off four world championships in succession. He won his fourth world championship by winning 9 races in a row. Never been done before. And then he jumps into the next season, 2014. Gets 4 podiums. And then straight away with a new team, with a car that he enjoys more, gets on the podium straight away. So that's it. You know, there's plenty of evidence like that that answers your question about what the car does. But the drivers, the special drivers are the special drivers. Not just anybody could jump in there and do what the big boys do.
Fascinating. All right, I'll get you out of here on this, Lee. Another major story from Australia, the debut of 17-year-old wunderkind Max Verstappen. We've seen prodigies appear in other sports. Of course, we all remember Freddie Adu, 14 years old, making his MLS debut. We see young kids all the time, soccer, football, basketball, you name it. But here's a kid racing a multi-million dollar machine, 200 miles an hour. It's quite extraordinary to think about it because so many of us at 17, we're just learning how to drive. And here he is competing in the world's most fantastic, most expensive racing series. How do you even begin to think about racing in Formula One? Not at your local dirt track, Formula One. How do you even begin to do that at 17 years old?
Well, you know, I think he probably didn't even make that choice. It was just destiny. I mean, it was all laid out in front of him. His dad, you know, stood on the podium in Formula One several times. He did 107 Grand Prix, Jos Verstappen. His mum, Sophie Compton, is an accomplished driver herself. So when you grow up with your dad being, you know, a Formula One driver, and he's a Le Mans winner, he won the LMP2 class at Le Mans, Jos Verstappen. So when your dad is a ex-Formula One driver and a Le Mans champion, and your mum is also a competitive driver as well, it's kind of laid out for you. So he started, like a lot of them, like Lewis Hamilton did, and Vettel. He started very young in karts, but his story is truly special. And for a 17-year-old, just even forget that he's a Formula One driver. For a 17-year-old, this kid is so mature, and he just takes it all in his stride. And I felt very sorry for him that his car retired the other day. He didn't retire. He didn't crash it. He didn't do anything wrong. Car retired. Otherwise, that would have been a tremendous story, because for sure he would have scored points. And so not only does he now hold the record of being the youngest driver to ever compete in Formula One, he would have been the youngest ever point scorer, which Danny Kaffiyat owns that record at the moment. But he's got plenty of time on his side this year to even break Kaffiyat's record. So I have no doubt that he's going to score points soon. But yeah, as far as how do you even think about that? Well, I mean, his talent did it for him, because Helmut Marko, who controls the dollar pipeline into, you know, to Red Bull and makes a lot of the decisions for Dietrich Mateschitz, who owns Red Bull, he saw him and he just said, we need to get hold of this kid. Simple as that. The whole Red Bull model is embracing youth and everything that these talented youngsters have to offer. And when you look at talent versus age, then age really therefore is just a number, because he has the talent. And he and his 20-year-old teammate, Carlos Sainz Jr., proved that the other day. So here you have two kids, Carlos Jr., who's the son of a two-time World Rally Champion, and then you've got Max, the son of a former F1 driver and Le Mans winner. They grow up around it. They see their parents as global athletes and motor racing stars, and they grow up in that environment. So therefore, there's not a whole lot that can shock them, because they're living in it. You know, it's like my kids. I have two sons. They see me on TV every week. You know, which is weird, right? My dad was a painter. I didn't see my dad on TV ever. And but when you grow up around it, it's just normal. And so that's why I don't think they got shocked by it. And they did an amazing job. And for Sainz, to finish ninth and get 2 points on debut was awesome. I think Verstappen would have done that as well. And that there in itself, you know, you can make a decision as a fan and also as a broadcaster. You can focus on the negative, and we could get mired in all of the controversy and the things that, you know, weren't that great in Melbourne, or we could embrace, you know, the fresh names in the sport. And I mentioned before, Nasser, he's 22, and for Sauber to come off their worst season in 22 years last year, not didn't score a single point, they've been taken to the Victorian Supreme Court by a driver, and then let alone, you know, and then lo and behold, on Sunday when the lights go out, they get both drivers in the points and score 14 points. I mean, it was just, you know, to me that's a terrific story, and there's lots of positives. Now, I know that there's some challenges out there at the moment, but there's still lots and lots of positives about the 2015 Formula One season.
It seems like F1 is becoming more and more a young man's sport. I just can't imagine those 17. I think at that age I was scared to change lanes on the freeway. So to think that he's out there racing at Formula One, all these young guys, it's pretty remarkable. All right, we like to finish, Lee, with a bold prediction from our guest. So give me your best shot at this. 20 races this year, Lewis Hamilton already 1-for-1. How many races does Hamilton win this year? How many races do Mercedes win this year? Can they go 20-for-20?
Yes. Yes, they can. This could be the perfect season. This is something that Steve Matchett really wound up. He's excited about this. And he's not, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that he's a Mercedes fan. He's, you know, after living and breathing and working in the pit lane and being a part of a two-time World Championship winning team at Benetton, he knows what goes into a World Championship campaign, and therefore, you know, he appreciates it perhaps to a different level than others, and he's fascinated by just the possibility at the perfect season. So when that went out the window last year in Canada, when Hamilton had ERS failure and the brakes failed, and then Rosberg had the same challenge and Ricciardo won, well, that was it. It was over. The perfect season couldn't happen. But yes, to answer your question, yes, I think they can. I think they can win all 20 or all 19 once we get an official ruling on Germany.
That'd be fascinating to follow season long. All right, our thanks to Lee Diffie for joining us today. Follow him on Twitter at Lee Diffie, and catch him and the rest of the NBC crew when they return to Formula One in 2 weeks from Malaysia. Lee, a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of the season, and hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you, and just to say hi, and thanks to all of your listeners, and to say thanks to Awful Announcing. I'm a regular reader, and you guys are very kind to me after my Olympic debut last year, so I appreciate that, and appreciate you taking the time to talk about NBC and motorsport properties. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lee.